Okay. Welcome, everybody. This next installment of Adventures in American Judaism, we're going to look at what behind the laughter. We're going to look at the history of the Purim spiel as it migrates from Europe and to the United States. First source. And so here we're going to actually, I think this is the first time that we're going to not just focus on America, but also think about how Europe and European Judaism loomed large for this American precedent. Misaprim. This is from a little known journal called the Hatzfira. It's by Moshe Eisenstadt, an article called Purim Rav. I have the Hebrew and I produced an English translation for everybody to follow on below. Misaprim. It's told, meaning in 1916, there was a tradition that was known to some degree or another, she misada that shall a yeshiva hazot, that on the founding of the yeshiva, that is the Eitz Chaim Yeshiva in Volozhin, founded by Rabbi Chaim Volozhin or Rabbi Chaim of Volozhin, in 1802, Hagaon HaTzadik, Reb Chaim, that would be the founder, Reb Chaim of Volozhin, Talmido shel Hagaon HaGra Mevilna, the leading disciple of the Gaon of Vilna, Rabbi Vilna Gaon, dies in 1797, so he does not live to see the founding of the Yeshiva in Volozhin, but it's his inspiration to some extent. Asher Yeshiva Hayita Nikreit al Shemo, Eitz Chaim was called after, not really, but Reb Chaim Volozhiner hid his name in it. It was called the Eitz Chaim Yeshiva, but it was always known as the Yeshiva in Volozhin. It was always known as Volozhin. Vuhaya Nikra al Shem Ha'ir HaYeshiva, and it was known, and he and the yeshiva were known because it was in this city with a Jewish infrastructure, but by no means a big city, the Lithuanian town of Volozhin. Hu shekava et minhag hazeh shel Purim Rav. And it was well known that he was the one who established the concept of a Purim rabbi or a Purim gabbai, which would eventually evolve into the full-on spiel, the whole-on pageant and play. Give me 1 second. Let me just make sure that all other pingings from my computer are off. So he developed this idea of a Purim rabbi. What was the Purim rabbi, where you would appoint somebody to lampoon the yeshiva? Vehu shishamato lechok b'yeshiva digmulato. He had a particular purpose, a particular agenda, instituting the Purim rabbi minhag custom. Rotza haya ledat. He wanted to know hachisroniot sheban hagat hayeshiva. He wanted to know where he could get better. What were the failings? What were the issues, the challenges that the yeshiva was up to snuff? Asher hu lo aman aleihem, that he hadn't yet figured out. V'som talmid lo hirhiv le'irotzo aleihem. So he wanted to know things that no student would ever have the audacity, the chutzpah, the moxie, to report to Reb Chaim of Volozhin what the problem was. He knew that he was revered. He knew that traditional comportment had it. There was no student council. There were no grievances. There were no appeal processes. And Reb Chaim Volozhin, therefore, he had a yeshiva that he understood humbly could always do better. The problem was that the consumer, so to speak, the students, had no comfortable way of reporting to him how he could get better. Lepikach kava et yom b'shana. Therefore, he established one annual occasion, Yom HaPurim, on Purim, shebo hitiru lehem gam chazav al. There even our sages gave some sort of permission to make light, to make merry. She'az haya adam atami b'meshach kol hayom chov shiv ma'asa b'shlid levado b'nyanei yeshiva. And they would allow one well-selected student to run the yeshiva. Umemela yidbaru az hamaasim she'enam shel harav mikol hashana. And he would learn then that whatever, and it wouldn't just be this one student acting alone, but the student, he, only a man in the yeshiva, young man in the yeshiva, would learn sort of through the avirah, through the culture, and through the lampooning, what the Purim rabbi could teach the rabbi 364 days, not quite that in Hebrew calendar, of the year. Yada Acharkach, he would therefore learn after the Purim lampoon with Litakein et Amod Lehisir Mibliya Lehinagefa Lavo. And he would therefore learn how not to introduce challenges or mistakes or to fix what was going on. So it was very strategic. Was the Purim Rabbi, Purim Gabbai tradition, Ruchai V'lajner understood that the only way to get better is to get constructive criticism, and the best way to do that was to institute, in his mind, the Purim Rav tradition, in which you understood that Purim was a day for Leitzanus, or Leitzanut, a day for conviviality, a day for a little bit of silliness, but, and once the Purim Rabbi finished up Purim, that was it. Everybody and everything was back in order. It was controlled chaos to some extent or another. And that would provide a window into how Reb Chaim of Volozhin could improve the yeshiva. Brilliant. Now, of course, the Purim spiel or the Purim skit can all go all the way back to medieval France and Germany with the concept of Carnival. I'm not at all dismissing the Purim skits that we have that go back to the Middle Ages. They weren't necessarily funny. A lot of them focused on either the Purim story, or they wove in the story of Yosef and his brothers. But the modern conception of the Purim spiel really stems from Reb Chaim of Volozhin and the beginning of the 19th century. And apparently it was a hit. It was a smash success. Rabbi Yaakov Lifshitz, the author of the commentary Tiferet Yisrael on the Mishnah, Odeni zocher bilodeti, I recall from my childhood, he writes in his memoir, Kishishab, Bo kama talmidim lehorehem al yimei chag hamatzot, that when Passover break, when Pesach break would take place, all of the students would come back by train, back to their villages, back to their small towns. A lot of the people, the wise men of the city, would want to know, tell us about the Purim Rabbi. So it was a well-known thing. Here, not only would they pay attention in Volozhin, but they would pay attention in the outskirts. Nobody really was from the Yeshiva of Volozhin. They all boarded, didn't have a dormitory. That would be much later with Lublin. They would stay in people's homes in Volozhin. It was good economics. It was good income for the community in Volozhin. It kept them happy with the yeshiva. And these boarders would return back home for Passover break, some a month or maybe less from when the Purim Rabbi skit took place. And everybody wanted to know, how was the Purim spiel? How was the Purim rabbi this year in Volozhin? So he goes on to talk about all the different satires and criticisms, all these so-called new rabbis, these Purim rabbis, new rabbis, rabbi for a day. They would want to know who they were, and Rabbi Yaakov Lifshitz continues that there were many, many famous people who took on that role of Purim Rav through the epics of the Yeshiva Volozhin's history. One such person was Rabbi Mordechai Gimbel Yaffe, and the following is reported: B'yeshiva nichshav harav Mordechai Gimbel l'charif u'mechut. One of the excellent students in the yeshiva was not rabbi then, but Mordechai Gimbel Yaffe. Ninubo chaverav et hanyanim livchor lo rav shel Purim. Apparently, he was elected not by the administration, but by the students. They voted him the Purim rabbi. This is not during the time of Rav Ruchaim Volozhin, but his son Itzel. Minhag shenoheg od b'yamei Chaim Volozhin, instituted by Ruchaim Volozhin again, well known to many writers who focus on this. Lefi minhag zeh, b'chol mibein ha'talmidei yeshiva, reish m'sivta, they selected ahead of the yeshiva. L'yom echad, for just one day, b'makom haram, ha'amiti shehaya, mitpater, mikunato l'yom b'oto yom. And everybody was in this controlled chaos once again. K'rav shapurim hayu, b'ochrim b'tamid ha'charif, v'ashonin b'yotin, they would pick a witty and a very smart person. And they would get b'ktav ha'rabbanu t'haya kotev hu, ahu rav l'chad yoma. There was a contract signed, apparently, that he would be just a rabbi for the day, would go back to normal, or revert back to the standard the following day on Shushan Purim. V'chi kol tarotav b'drushat tzirotol rak le'chidudei ba'al. He would always in the he would give a shiur. He would deliver a traditional Talmud shiur, and he would add in some witticisms throughout. Yiblishum kartuv shalom, but none of it would be true. Kasher nivchar harav Mordechai Gimbel Yaffa kirav shalpurim. The year that Mordechai Gimbel was selected as the Purim Rav, nitasu kol talmidim b'tochem rosh yeshiva revitzla, and everybody was there, crowded in to listen to his Purim Torah, including the Rosh Yeshiva of Itzla, Harab de Purim, Niksha, he made a mistake. V'higid pilpul amuk. Instead of teaching silliness and reflecting on the yeshiva, he just gave a knockout shiur. K'dei l'taritz kushe'achat. Standard procedure. He answered a question that he had. V'ikshe mina Yerushalmi al Rambam. In particular, he had a question, he problematized the Rambam based on a passage in the Talmud Yerushalmi. It seemed altogether true. This wasn't Purim Torah. This was just good Torah. But Talmidim panu l'Rabbi Itzla. They all turned. All the students turned to Rabbi Itzla, to their Rebbe, to their Rosh Yeshiva. Mibal edin et harav shel, and they complained to him. What is this? Mordechai Gimbel is supposed to be funny. He's not being funny. He's being perfect. Asher shina et ha'tanai shein damo. But he has violated the condition, which is he has to be a Purim rabbi. It's not allowed to teach true Torah. Itzla, Chayecha Amar, he smiled and he said, Omnam King, yeah, you're right. HaPilpul Kishu Atzmo Emetu. You're right. The methodology, it's right on. About Tzutzara, there's one problem. Harambam Yerushalmi Shalehem Nivne HaPilpul Hazeh, the Rambam and the Jerusalem Talmud, the Yerushalmi, that he based all that Torah on, Shneham. Lo hayu, v'lo nivro. They're made up. Ela she notru v'mocho shel harav shel Purim minecher v'mishal. They're figments of his imagination, of his brilliance. Okay, it's one example, one story about the Purim spiel, Purim rabbi in V'lezhin. When did the Purim rabbi tradition end in V'lezhin? Did it continue all the way until when the yeshiva was closed down in the 1890s? Well, it almost made it all the way, but not. What happened? According to Rav Meir Berlin, who wrote a memoir about his family, including the longtime Rosh Yeshiva, Rabbi Naftali Tzvi Yehuda Berlin, Netziv, Kishi Gia Legil Shel Shiduchem, Rabu Chatzim Bita Miriam. There was this woman, Batya Miriam, who was the sister of the Orach HaShulchan of Rabbi Yechiel Michal Epstein. And apparently she was very beautiful. And when it came time that she reached a marriageable age, everyone wanted to marry. Everybody wanted to court this Batya Miriam. Batya Avot, she wanted, she was, everybody really wanted to marry her. The smartest, the best of the students, of the wealthiest family, because she was quite beautiful, and she was quite smart. And she was educated and just very pleasant based on any standard of the time in the mid-19th century. Hebrew, she knew Russian, how to speak it, how to read it, how to write it, how to speak it, Bagami Kira, Bemina Musiamet, Etasafa, she also knew German. Ah, he hodia lahora. But she made clear to her parents, Kilola Osher, she didn't care about wealth, below Lenoy, not for little trinkets, below Litanugim, And then so it's, she didn't care about material stuff. Ritzuna ki bala yihei Talmud Chacham. She wanted to marry Talmud Chacham. The Osek b'Torah ulezeh kol moga. So they found her a so afal pikein nishad chalitzayir achad. The parents didn't listen. They married her off to one young man, Ben Asher Muflag Beer, that she was that there was a family from Chernev, I guess is how you would pronounce it, Chernigov. And remember, the family stood the gain. They didn't want to take the liability of the daughter and her raising her family. So they married her off, nevertheless, to a scion of a wealthy family in Chernigov. Adam Kasher v'Hagun, he was a nice fellow. V'gam hu, v'gam harav, ki tichu, ki yaktish man l'Torah. And they agreed that this young man who would marry this beautiful young woman, Bati Miriam, would... he would learn Torah. And they would speak Torah. Wonderful idea. Lo avru yamim rabim, but it didn't take very long. What happened? But Isha Akira Babal, ki omnam hu yoshe belomate, even though her young husband, her chasan, spent significant time sitting and learning, ba'al et hasfarim, hina v'hina, and he looked around in all the different books in his probably considerable library. Aval ein chachmara Torah bikirbo. He just didn't have it in him. Ve'ein kishrono, ve'ein nafsho liyidat Torah liyot lulamdi. He couldn't be a lamdan. He just could not be a Talmud scholar. He tried his best, but he could not succeed. Kasher hayitam akira v'yodah mi beit aviyah mishpatem. When it came time, they got a divorce. They got a divorce, and she couldn't marry the person. She told her parents, "I need to marry a Talmud Chacham. I can't live the Chaye Amaratus. I can't be married to an Amaratus." Okay, fast forward. So, when that happened, the Nitziv lost his first wife, and before long, she found a Talmud Chacham. This Bati Miriam did to marry, and she married the Rosh Yeshiva of Belezhin. She married the Nitziv. So now I'm in sorry, I said it wrong. She was the daughter of the Aruch HaShulchan. She was the brother of Baruch HaLevi Epstein, the Makor Baruch. I'm sorry, Torah Tamima. Let's correct that. Lu'umadza, Haita Achoti b'nesua tzira liyamin. My sister was married at a very young age. That's what I just reported to you. Bria B'Shamah, she was vivacious. Mochanet b'kol ha'malot midon na'alot la'anshei ma'ala b'kabel b'klal la'ishas chayal b'akar d'abayit v'prat v'yi b'yom ha'purim. And so, but then it came down that she was in her first year of marriage to the Nitziv. Purim came. Now, the Nitziv was embroiled in conflict. The students preferred the teachings of his relative, Rabbi Chaim Brisker, Reb Chaim Soloveitchik, the grandfather of Rabbi Joseph V. Soloveitchik. And they actually went on strike, and they didn't want to listen to the Nitziv. It was a very complicated thing that went on in Belezhin. But suffice it to say that the Nitziv and his marriage to a much younger, beautiful woman was not missed by the student body, and so it came time for the annual Purim Rav. The first Purim came finally during their first year of marriage. He embarrassed her a little, as was the spirit of the day. So when he said that my uncle's marriage might help interpret the following Talmudic citation, one second marriage, I believe it's the beginning of Gemara and Sota. One second marriage is based on their actions, right? The idea that you're preordained to marry your first spouse. The second one is based on more calculations of your actions. I don't know exactly what that means. I'm still on the marriage, happily on the marriage of the one God intended for me. Kolomar, ki mishehu mechonin b'masim tovim, v'tov l'fi ha. Now he understands on second marriage based on his actions. In other words, an individual who is kind and generous to his first wife will merit his second wife. So based on how you treat your first wife, your first spouse, that's what you will get in your second. So obviously, Sid was very good to his deceased wife, rather inflammatory, rather unkind, and so he deserved this young bride. In any case, that was the last Parnspiel in Valesia. Makes sense. Okay. But the focus of our discussions has always been on America, but I do want to cover a little bit of Europe. One other funny incident that just so that we have full literacy of the Purim tradition in Valesian, is by Rosh Svinaria. He wrote voluminously about his teacher, Rav Kook, Rav Avraham Yitzchak Kohen Kook. And not only did the Purim spiel, Purim rabbi tradition migrate to the United States, but it also migrated to Israel. Apparently during his, I think, 6 months in Valesian, Rav Kook was selected as the Purim rabbi, and he lampooned, this was obviously before it was canceled by Reina Batya, he lampooned the Nitziv, the Rosh Yeshiva there. And much later on, in Merkaz HaRav Kook, Merkaz HaRav, he continued that tradition, and there was so years ago, I'll just read in English, one of the excellent students chosen as the Purim rabbi was the Nitziv's great-grandson, Rabbi Yitzchak Harif. So the Nitziv's anical, the Nitziv's grandson, great-grandson, had was enrolled in the yeshiva of Merkaz HaRav, where Rav Kook was the Rosh Yeshiva. And apparently, this Rabbi Yitzchak Harif did a bang-up job imitating Rav Kook. HaRav Shehichshiv Ma'od et Rav Yitzchak. And Rav Kook was really impressed by this impersonation, and it occurred to him, V'af haya he admitted that he was he didn't know exactly how brilliant this Rabbi Yitzchak Harif was. He didn't know he was also a comedian. And he said in good nature, Achshav Mashivim Li Kigmulai. Now I'm getting my just desserts, I'm getting my what I deserve. Hanin Machzir Li Yerushalayim, it's come back to pay me in Jerusalem. Divrei Be'oznei HaSaba Shalom Nivlajan. I did a bang out job imitating the Nitziv, and now the Nitziv's great grandson has done a fantastic job imitating. Okay. In any case, the Purim rabbi tradition clearly in Europe was taken in good fun, until it wasn't, and it was used pedagogically. It was used. I should even say strategically, of where the administration, first with the Reb Chaim Volozhin, then Reb Itzla, and then the Nitziv, used the Purim Rav tradition in order to get perspective and feedback in a controlled way from the student body. They would use it. They would use the lampooning to get at the kernel, get at even at the core of how they could improve the yeshiva in some way or another, knowing very safely that things would return to normal until the Nitziv's wife kibashed it. We have a tradition by the 1950s in an excerpt from Hadoar, a Hebrew language weekly journal, a Hebraic journal in America, Gamla America, Ba'am Minhagim Ha'ela, America, eventually the Purim Rav tradition. This article is called Malchei Purim, the Kings of Purim. B'Yeshiva V'Lajan, Kigone, all the Purim tradition that was founded in V'Lajan, B'Yeshiva Hagadola, Kigone, Ha'yeshiva, and where did it move to? Kigone, Ha'yeshiva, Al Shem, Rabbi Yitzchak Elchanan, Ubeis Medrash Kabbalah Beleikvud, Moshe Metarabanim. These rabbis would rule in the Rabbi Isaac Elchanan Yeshiva, which is Reitz, which is Yeshiva University, and even in Beis Medrash Kabbalah, BMG, the Yeshiva in Lakewood. Halalu, Bekipa, Bimea Purim, these ruled with Bekipa, with force. That's what it says in English. With force, they would rule on Purim. So they migrated, not just there, but also to Tells had a prominent tradition. The Philadelphia Yeshiva which is a satellite of the Lakewood Yeshiva, the Perm Rav tradition migrated very comfortably to the United States. Not just that, but it also expanded. So, for example, let me move the zoom controls. I participated in this. I guess this is more than a little autobiographical, maybe, although I wasn't alive at the time for these. The student newspaper, The Commentator. Their annual issue wasn't just in the Purim Rav or in the Purim Spiel. Eventually, it really becomes a spiel. But the newspaper would once a year create a lampoon. It started in the 40s, but I just grabbed a few from the 60s to share. We won't read them at great length, but if you take a look in the battles between Rabbi Isaac Klein of the conservative movement and Rabbi Tendler, Rabbi Moshe David Tendler of Yeshiva University, on the battle of whether or not tuna and swordfish are kosher. Kashrut king of tuna fish fame sent on 3-year Samoan sabbatical. There was a whole scientific analysis about whether or not tuna was kosher. Eventually, Rabbi Tendler lost that battle, I think, to most of the people within the Orthodox Union and elsewhere. What it really does connote, that is in the 60s and the 70s, food, you learn a lot from food. You learn a lot from the food ways and the folk ways that we adopt, and what is served on your Shabbos table is a big deal. And one of the parting of the ways, even at this late date, between the conservative movement and the Orthodox movement, wasn't tuna, but it was swordfish. And they poke fun lightly about the issue. In the 1970s, Hartstein names Billy Graham as new yeshiva president. Dr. Miller cites appointment as change for the better. They were not very happy with President Belkin, I suppose. Here's another one. Belkin announces new school based on one of the longtime administrators, Sheldon Sokol. Sokol, SOB. So a play on words. You can understand that acronym, I think, quite well. To open in the fall. That's on the third item. In 1974, the tradition is alive and well. This is actually not 74, excuse me, this is 1954, because Yeshiva University's College for Women will open in the fall. That was the big line, that Stern College would open in 1954. But below that, there was also a plan to name a new medical school, Einstein. So Einstein, therefore, dutifully appeared in the Perm Spiel that year and was greeted by, because he had to kosher, so to speak, Albert Einstein. And so none other than Rabbi Yerachem Yigirelik was lampooned as well in the Perm Spiel that year, and the two found a peaceful way forward. Einstein representing sort of this graduate medical training, and the yeshiva proper, led by one of the more traditionalist exponents, Rabbi Yerachem Yigirelik. And that was the theme of the Perm Spiel. And again, you sort of learn from in 1954, what was at stake at yeshiva at that time? Perm Spiels, just like with Bati Miriam, Perm Spiels and Perm commentators got quite sensitive and testy at times. Here, this is Shelley Rudolph's memory from the book My Yeshiva College, edited by Menachem Butler and Zev Nagel, probably around, well, probably 20 years ago. Gee whiz. A quiet, but I remember when it came out. A quiet but significant change had taken place at The Commentator as well, recalls Rudolph. For years, its senior editors were undergraduates who were not enrolled in the yeshiva program. So these were in the learning program that wasn't the highest tier. Since the editors were selected by the outgoing board, this was a situation that was quite easy to perpetuate. So all the people from a particular morning program selected their peers. And so it continued in the commentator ranks for decades. A mistaken impression that freedom of the press was exercised too freely by the commentator often placed it beyond the pale of acceptability in the eyes of certain members of the administration, faculty, and student body. Inexplicably, in 1952, and for many years thereafter, the senior leadership of the commentator was taken up by yeshiva program students. All of a sudden, the ones in the traditional learning program we call it the Mazer Yeshiva program today, who may have been no less irreverent, they were still kids, or restrained than their predecessors. Dr. Belkin, Samuel Belkin was president at the time, however, sensed the shift and seized the opportunity to install Rabbi Israel Miller, a distinguished alumnus, as advisor to the publication, eventually becomes vice president at NYU. We were informed that Rabbi Miller would not serve as a censor. However, all material was required to be reviewed by him before publication. It became a ritual to slip under Rabbi Miller's door at his nearby Bronx home. He was a rabbi in the Bronx. In the wee hours of the morning, articles which were simultaneously sent to the printer for publication. It was a great tribute to Rabbi Miller's skills as the consummate diplomat and gentleman, attributes that were recognized in the ensuing years by the great esteem in which he was held by the American Jewish community, that he exercised his role to suggest, cajole, and persuade. Rarely, if ever, did those of us at the commentator clash with him over content or policy. Well, after Rabbi Miller no longer had time to be the advisor, not censor, of the commentator, the Purim, the newspaper you see over here, and the big headline, even above the masthead, no Purim commentator this year. The advisor then was Rabbi Tendler of Swordfish and Tuna fame. And he refused to allow the Purim commentator to come out that year. He was the new advisor. A quiet but significant change has taken place. Oh, sorry if that was something else. No Purim commentator. There will be no Purim commentator, no written spiel this year, announced Jacob Leibowitz, editor-in-chief of the commentator. Mr. Leibowitz stated that the reason for the departure from tradition is due to the complications in the publication of the Purim issue brought about by mishandling and delays on the part of the commentator's advisors. Mr. Marvin Hershkowitz and assistant dean, Rabbi Moses D. Tendler, goes on. In the fuller part of it, the commentator argues, successfully or not, I'm not sure, that this is a bigger issue, that if you cannot allow the students to own Purim, then you cannot allow the students to have what they deserve in a collegiate atmosphere, not necessarily an yeshiva one. And that was part of the tension between a yeshiva university, maybe still is, between the protocol for how to behave on Purim, whether you are a yeshiva or a university, or in this case, a yeshiva university. Let's go to Chicago, where the Purim Spiel had particular theatrical investment. Something to know about, it's both schools were founded or really emerged at the beginning of the 20th century. Yeshiva traces itself all the way back to the 1880s with Eitz Chaim Yeshiva, and then finally with the founding of the Advanced Yeshiva after the passing of Yitzchak Spector in 1897. But they were both reorganized and were really properly situated in the 1910s, 1915 and 1917, respectively. HTC in Chicago, now part of Touro University. If you take a look at their enrollment, you'll notice that things really start to spike in the late 1960s, and then in both in the rabbinic department, the college department, as well as the high school counterpart of the Chicago school. By then, in its current facility in Skokie, Illinois. How does one explain the increase in the late 1960s? Well, if it's not well known to you, it will be in a second. So the Purim Spiel at Skokie Yeshiva was something of a legend. They really embraced the Broadway scene at the time. So right, this was not Frank Sinatra's Bye Bye Birdie, but Bye Bye Beardy in 1964. Not West Side Story, but where Skokie Yeshiva, not Yeshiva, but Yeshiva was located. It moved just recently from the West Side to the North Side, so it was called North Side Story. I won't sing it for you, but this is a lyric where they lampoon Bye Bye Birdie to the tune of Put on a Happy Face. So Joseph Babad was the dean of the college. So you might be conscripted. Put on a happy face. The lead character, not Sinatra, Beardy. All my charusa skipped it, and I will feel out of place. Will I be able to go to Minyan there? Keep kosher as well. Just don't be disappointed when you're there. It's not a hotel. Beardy comments at the end of the lampoon of the song, and the whole thing is full of they're really well done, really interesting. I have a complete set almost. You won't eat tangerines now. The food will be good. You'll see just potatoes and beans now, and you will get cookies and tea. But what is the main item that I'm calling to your attention? So you might get conscripted. If you leave the yeshiva, excuse me, why did the enrollment spike? Partly it was to do with the emergence of a new Rosh Hashiva, Rabbi Aaron Soloveitchik, but a lot to do with if you were enrolled in a rabbinical program, you were exempt for service into Vietnam temporarily, although a student that eventually even seminary students were conscripted into the army as well. But that explains much of the spike in the enrollment over here. It wasn't just the Orthodox, certainly. Here are the notes. I mentioned tuna. So Rabbi Isaac Klein, who became a very important figure in the Committee of Jewish Law and Standards of the Conservative Movement of the Rabbinical Assembly, here is his notebook of all of the, not just the Purim Torah here on your left. Well, he produced content that was quite funny of maybe of, I don't know if it rivaled, I can't say, of Rabbi Mordechai Gibel Yaffa, but he also wrote scripts that would and plays we have in his notebook at University of Buffalo. Not quite sure why his archives are there still, but he also created skits to be produced as a young student in the seminary. And not just the conservative movement, but Hebrew Union College also had a Purim spiel tradition. So it was really intra-denominational. Here is one from 1942, How Green Was My Chaplain, a prelude. I'll just grab one quick line. Gutman, did you hear about the Orthodox rabbis who visited today, who d visited Today, visited, excuse me, visited my Shulchan Aruch class the other day. Sorry, let me read it again. Did you hear about the Orthodox rabbis who visited my Shulchan Aruch class the other day? Was I embarrassed? I guess this is Jacob Rader Marcus. Why? What happened? Gutman, the class was unprepared. Cohen, so I guess all the faculty. How can you tell the difference? Well, one of the boys was reading the text upside down. Of course, there were no women yet admitted to HUC, so it was boys. Sometimes it's better that way. I often stand on my head too to read the text. When does this? So then they continue on and on. You see that they barely play off of sort of the level of capacities and literacy. Some HUC students have become obviously masterful Talmudists and are great scholars and definitely read Hebrew text the right side up, not upside down. But you see that they share a window into some of the criticisms of HUC at the time. And it wasn't just for rabbis in training, but in the 1960s, not a long-lived pamphlet called Prakim, a monthly program manual for synagogue activity of the Union of Jewish Congregations of America, the OU, produced a guide of how to produce a minstrel show. Preparation. They offered, if you take on the right side, how to lay out your synagogue auditorium. And even later on in the same pamphlet, they offer a sample skit, a generic one, for congregations, for lay leaders, and maybe their rabbis too, to mark up and tailor to their own needs. But And we see this, that in Hillels, in synagogues, in day schools, the Purim became a great opportunity for gathering, but also as a unique opportunity to paint a picture very safely to provide constructive criticism to the powers that be. Can talk about the Purim Spiel tradition in the United States. I think I'll thank my wonderful friend again, Menachem Butler, for providing these PDFs to me. I believe the Not Jewish Press in the late 70s, this is from 79 and 82. I think there are only two volumes. Messiah Arrives in 79, exclusive to Not the Jewish Press, in what has to be the greatest event since the splitting of the Red Sea. Our Israeli correspondents have just learned that the Messiah has finally arrived. After many false alarms and a few hoaxes over the years, this time we are sure. Okay. And then take a look on here after Ahmad Sadat was assassinated, Sadat alive. Eventually, though, it doesn't work. In the United States, because it was a much more porous community, all of a sudden they understood, did the rabbinic heads. It's still around. I'm not suggesting all there is the Purim, but the Purim Spiel got put on a shorter leash. Certainly by the 1970s and by the 1980s, absolutely. Some of the more traditional yeshivas, for example, Torah Vadas and its Rosh Yeshiva by Avraham Palm, downplayed the value of Purim Torah and the Purim Spiel. And he writes in his Atara Lamelech, Yishno Gim Lomar, Divrei Torah on Yenei HaMegillah V'Chag U'Betah. Shazad Davar Beito, the Davar Naim. Yeah, for sure. These are, it's important to have convivial Torah. Abal Yesh, Shaomrim, Purim Torah, but people who articulate these Purim Torahs, Mubabalim, Divrei HaMegillah, and Divrei Chazal, they make fun and they leverage and they militate against the traditions of our sages of Chazal. It becomes too silly. And it's really it's not a good thing, offers Rav Palm. So I found very recently in Nassim Sherman's collected almost Dear Abby question and answers that were published, I think, in the Yeted Haman, if I'm correct. He offered, I don't know what, I know when this was published in 2017, I don't know when it was originally, but he reflects on the period of when he was a student in Rav Palm's Torah V'das Yeshiva. I am Machanechas, so that means I'm a teacher, a woman teacher, of an 8th grade Beis Yaakov class. My students, on the left side over here, will be putting on a Purim program for the school and would very much like to make a Purim spiel using the teachers as the characters and mimicking them in a humorous way. These are very sensitive and respectful young ladies, albeit with a strong sense of fun. As their mechanechas, more like a principal type of figure, I am not sure of the chinuch message, the education message, the sense. One teacher commented, this is not something she would allow her children to do if they asked, so the same would apply to her students. Others maintain that this is a healthy outlet for their shtick, as long as it is supervised. I would appreciate your input. Writes the longtime editor of Art Scroll, Rabbi Nessen Sherman. Many years ago in Torah Vadas, the night of Purim was play and gramen time, including gentle and sometimes not so gentle spoofs of people and activities in the yeshiva. In fact, this writer, Rabbi Sherman, wrote and sang a gramen more than once. After a time, the Rosh Yeshiva, Zvi Palm, felt it was getting out of hand and put an end to it. I'm sure the writer is right when she says that the performance will be in good taste and that the faculty advisor can be relied on to make sure that this is the case. However, times have changed. The standards of Derech Eretz, of comportment and propriety, are far lower than they used to be. Although I personally am a proponent of good, clean humor in Purim, on Purim, I fear that we may well be on a slippery slope. Mechanchim, educators everywhere bemoan how much more difficult the profession is today than it used to be. In a way, it's similar to the question of uniforms in girls' schools. Most mechanchim, teachers again, and mechanechos, women teachers, a generation or two ago were opposed They felt that students should learn to maintain standards of tznius with regular dress. In time, all agreed this was not working. In response to the specific inquiry, the Purim spiel should not be canceled. Girls have been neglecting class work for weeks or months preparing for them. They should not have their plans abruptly ended, but for the future, the school might be best advised to plan a wholesome, fun-filled Purim without teachers, parents, or students being the butt of ridicule. So keep it this year, advised Rabbi Sherman, because they had the girls, the young women had already applied themselves and produced something, but maybe you should cancel it for next year. Returning back to Chicago in 1981, now in the high school, when the yearbook came out in 1981, and it came time to for the page dedicated to for Purim and the Purim spiel, it was announced that it was canceled. Every year there is a Purim spiel. The yeshiva, the rich tradition, has been a unifying force for the student body. This year, because the yeshiva wanted a happy Purim, it canceled the spiel in favor of a masiba, in favor of a party. Efforts were made to change the administration's mind, but they remain intransigent. They wouldn't do it. It is too bad that the administration made this short-sighted decision because the spiel that we had started to write was very funny. This page is dedicated to the memory of a good Purim. In other words, the spiel culture migrated to the United States, and it worked for as long as it could. But eventually, and whether you argue that American youth sensibilities became something that they couldn't control, or maybe, in this case, the Orthodox rabbinate had moved to be more conservative and circumspect about how much they could tolerate on Purim, probably it's a little bit of both. It's always the best answer, nuance. Either way, the Purim spiel no longer became so ubiquitous in the United States. Certainly has its traditions, but it certainly can no longer be relied upon as that major lever to seek input comfortably for students and to take that feedback and exercise improvement for the yeshiva. That was Reb Chaim Bleichner's intention. Apparently his successors no longer think it is as strategic as it was some 200 years ago. Okay. I see that there's some questions in the chat. I'll open them, but the first example of Purim Torah is Megillat Esther. Okay. Let's see if there are any questions. Did any of the girls' school seminary Stern or female Turo have Purim spiels? You know, it's interesting. I never. That's a really interesting question, Shelley. My hypothesis would be there is something, and I say this in like a historical social way, there's something masculine about it. There's something about boys doing it. It's easy. We can just look at the Stern Observer, the newspaper, and see if there was ever a tradition at Stern College. I don't think so, but I don't know. But that's a really interesting question of why. And part of it was that I was incubated in an entirely boys environment, right? The yeshiva and Volozhin. But you don't see too much of it. And I'll even say that in my day at Ida Crown in Chicago, the boys did the Purim spiel, even though it was a co-ed school. It's interesting. Yeah, newspapers always had a, whether it's the Exponent in Philadelphia, the Jewish Week in New York, always had that tradition of a Purim satire as an insert. Absolutely, absolutely. And it came in different ways. So the Purim Rav, the Purim sort of this one-man show, eventually became newsprint. It became a whole play. Very elaborate in some occasions. Some of the pictures I should have shown you from Skokie, how they're dressed as they really took an interest. They dressed in these huge, elaborate costumes from Wizard of Oz and the like. And it was filled in Skokie. About 1,200 people, by one account, attended. The whole community came for the Purim spiel until it was canceled. Nowadays, I think the tradition has it that because with media, very often it's pre-recorded. That's a way to ensure a certain quality control. Shelley, go ahead.
The idea that just people are supposed to get drunk on Purim. I'm sure that no woman ever got drunk because she would have been, castigated. So that's why I had that question. I mean, certain things have changed for women, like they're able to learn Gemara and stuff like that, and certain things haven't. And I guess as a woman, I get upset about how there's still two standards for things that aren't really halachic.
It's a great point. I'm not a political scientist, but you're right. And there's something, there is a gendered through line through this that that I don't think I interrogated. And thank God, there's always more work to be done. But your consternation is well noted. And but as a historian, thinking about it, there's more work to be done. And if any of you have Purim spiels, send them over to me. If I have any stories from your days in whether it be in a synagogue school, a day school, a yeshiva, a hillel, I find the whole thing fascinating. It's really about lived religion. You find a lot of MS. You find a lot of truth, a lot of historical kernels embedded in these spiels. The fact that they would write them down is quite interesting.
In conservative, I grew up with a small town that only had a conservative shul. And for Purim there would be a Purim play, but it was a play of the story of Purim.
Yeah.
And they were always so, make everything Protestant. It had to be in the sense of being very orderly. There wouldn't have been anything. That would have been considered Orthodox,
right.
Old world stuff if you made fun of it.
In the synagogue school environment, it was a useful thing. I think I participated. I went to day school, but my shul, an Orthodox shul, I remember playing Antiochus, so not Purim, but Hanukkah. I have a vague memory of it. Thank goodness there weren't no phones to record it. But very much it was to encourage. It was sort of like a project to encourage Jewish literacy, so the kids would put on a spiel so that they better understood. And could convey the messages of the Purim story. It's not meant to be funny. It was just a good device to teach the Bible to children. But you're absolutely right. Okay. Well, this was a fun one. I've been looking forward to this since we started the series. I'm going to... just what's on tap for next week. Oh, we'll turn back actually to Chicago. Glad I introduced you to the Hebrew Theological College, because we're going to look at basketball, I guess, just in time for March Madness. We're going to take a look at a really interesting court case about the right to wear your yarmulke in basketball in Illinois. And what was at stake in the expectations of being able to do that? Don't have to know too much about basketball to be a part of our learning next week. Anyway, until then, great to share some late sentence with you all. And we'll continue that next week. Have a good week, everybody.
Thank you.